Well, again, thanks for your patience, and for all you environmental people, I'm glad you're here. This is the last of the sessions.
That's the first time I've heard as an environmentalist in a long time.
Well, you're kind. Anyway, it's good to have you here, and I hope you've picked up something for those of you that have been here all week. We kind of moved through a number of topics, decision-making, because in the end it's really tough making decisions, and that involves a lot more than just the environment, economics, technology, all of that. And sometimes in my role there, it's to get the environmental people to realize that there are more that go into the decision than mere science theory. And then the next day, I happen to be very interested in environmental law, and so we talked about some of the key issues between that, where's that boundary between the public and private good. And then yesterday, the theme was talking about some of the things other than climate change and energy and recycling that are part of the sustainability discussion. And again, as we ended yesterday, I think those things really need a lot of attention. One of the persons who I don't think has made it here yet today, we got talking about the thing I mentioned near the end of the hour, this wonderful conservation stewardship program, which I only have this one copy. If anybody really wants one of these, just give me your name here or something, and we can have some run off and maybe distribute it after, you know, I'll look for you after Vespers or something tonight. But it turns out it's a really fine program. One of the persons said she tried, a farmer in North Dakota, they tried to apply for this, but they didn't qualify. And I said the reason probably they didn't qualify is it's based on a point system, and there's not much money for it. So there's a limited amount of money. And so here's a person doing really good things, probably not doing any bad things, but ready to commit to a stewardship idea. But because funding is not going as much to the soil, the NR, the Natural Resources Conservation Service, which has been around for 70 years, or to some of the water things. So again, I hope you picked up on that. If you weren't there yesterday, the only thing I'll repeat is this concern for land in the United States. And population. U.S. population is 310 million, and it's going to be, for projections by reliable people, this is a Population Reference Bureau, which is as reliable as you can get, we will be at 440 million by the year 2050. So particularly for current college-age students, it's pretty easy to say from the time now you're about finishing college till the day you're near when you're going to retire, we're going to add 130 million people. And at the same time, if the current trend continues, we're losing about 800,000 acres of quality farmland per year. And if you multiply that by 40, that's going to mean we're going to have, by the time current college students are retiring, 32 million less acres in agriculture. And as we ended yesterday, that ought to be front page. That's a huge sustainability issue while we work on the issues of energy, new kinds of energy, so they all go together. But today, we're focusing on forestry. And this is one of the occasions, actually, I can give you the one handout right at the beginning, pass these around this half of the room. And this one actually is kind of an upbeat story. So in one way, it's kind of nice to, here we go. I think there might be one more to the back wall here. Here we go. This is kind of an upbeat story. And I think we're going to look at some slides, but rather than on and off with the slides to fit exactly the commentary, we'll talk about some things and then look at a few slides and then do the other. By the way, some people say, gee, doesn't this guy use the PowerPoint stuff? Yeah, I do that too at school. But I'm fortunate to be in a room at the college where I can use traditional slides, and I've got 20,000 plus of them. I know exactly where they are, and I can put together all kinds of programs quicker than we can put together any of the other. Plus, I can use a standard overhead. Plus, we can use what's called an Elmo, where you have to just put this under the light, and that projects on the screen. Or I can use the other, and they're all right there for ready availability. So you get used to why convert everything into one format, which in one way would be easier. But I want to treat today going through the history and build the story for what we have. And then there's a lot of stuff that's not on here that picks up where this book left off. And so therefore, the theme of the, to the day from exploitation to management, conservation, and who knows what. And so when the time is nearing the end here, we'll be talking about some really wonderful, positive initiatives that have happened in forestry in just the last few years. And so let's sort of begin by going through this. You can follow along the forest area, and we're looking at the outline page, which again, I use this in my intro lecture on forestry back at Augustana. That's, I guess I should introduce myself. I'm Norm Moline. I'm in the Geography Department at Augustana College, the one in Rock Island, Illinois, and a co-advisor of our Environmental Studies and Environmental Management program. And we have a linkage with Duke University in forestry and in environmental management. Students can spend 3 years with us. Duke lets them into their graduate program a year early, so they can go in with only a junior. They go into graduate school, they spend 1 year at Duke, and then at the end of that year, Augustana accepts that first year of graduate school, the equivalent of our senior year. They come back, get a Bachelor of Arts from us, and then they go back down to Durham, North Carolina at the end of the second year, and they get a Master's in Forestry or a Master's in Environmental Management. It's a wonderful program. So I don't pretend to be the forestry expert, but we want to introduce students a little to it, so when they go down to Duke, they're kind of a little ready to get into the 2 full years of nothing but forestry. Forest area in pre-colonial America, 950 million acres. That was about half of the United States at the time. Before the mid-1800s, most of the decrease in our forest land came from conversion to other uses. Farmers along in the New England, the Virginia area, Pennsylvania, and on down, they cut the trees so that they could have some clearings in the woods for agriculture. The total cleared area by 1850 then, you can see, was estimated only 114 million acres had been cleared. Then other things happened. By 1879, the estimated cleared area, 223 million. You're for the most part still working in the east, although this is the time in which Weyerhaeuser got going in Illinois, and we'll get back to that in a minute. By 1920, the estimated cleared land, about 350 million acres according to one estimate, or I prefer I think the other one is more reliable, which would have us in the upper 400 million acres had been cleared. And if you do your subtraction at that point, you will see that we were down to about 480, 490 million acres of forest land in the United States by 1920. Now, some of that clearing was for increased demand for wood for industrial and fuel purposes, which became the principal motivation for logging. And to jump ahead of the story, if you go down near the end of this, we're only using 87 data because this book, which has not been updated, this particular one, a historical look at the resources in the U.S., by 1987, we were back up to 730 million acres. So this is one of these resources where you have the curve going down, and then by 1920, we'd had 10, 20 years of people talking about better forest management, and we start to add, so we have added back about 250 million acres of land that was not in forest, that now is again. Geographer with the Forest Service did a wonderful book on a study. His technique of doing research was actually to take a look at a given date and then go back to the same location and take another view of the same place. And he did a book on the Colorado Front Range. And so he got old photos in 1900, 1910, 1920, and then went back basically to exactly the same angle where the person was taking the photo in the late 1970s, early 1980s. And I swear, in virtually every one of those photos, the landscape looked better in the second batch of photos, which after so many other things, you know, this is the way it looked, and oh my goodness, look what we've done to the environment and how bad it was. In this case, you look at the book, it was pretty awful in 1910, 1920, with the cutting of the trees in the Front Range for the mining communities and everything else. And now you go back, gee, a lot of wood sections that were totally evidence of human habitation now are back to woods. And that's what I mean, there's partly a good story here, and we'll build that as the time goes on. Notice how the center of lumbering moved. We think of it now as a western phenomena of the Colorado or the Pacific Northwest or the southern area, the southern pine. But of course we see the center of lumbering in prior to 1839 was in Maine. To show how much that's changed, there's a place up in Maine where we've sometimes gone, and those lumber mills are closed now. We've got, just in my lifetime, pictures of some of those Maine rivers. They were still floating logs down, and this is what we're talking mostly in the 1970s, logs floating down these rivers. That's not happening there, so you can see how things move and change. New York, it had started to move, so by the 1830s, the center of the lumbering industry there. Pennsylvania drifted south a little bit, so that was the center in 1860. Michigan, 1870. The Lake States, which, Michigan's a lake state too, but this means Wisconsin and Minnesota, had become the center of the lumbering industry in the 1880s. And here, gotta digress from the outline. This is, so many of you from the Northwest with Weyerhaeuser out here, or different ways that that's pronounced. They began in Rock Island, Illinois. And the people in the headquarters of Weyerhaeuser in Federal Way, Washington, as some of you may know, not too far from just south of Seattle, we go there every other year with students on a field trip. One of my classmates works in the R&D section of Weyerhaeuser, and so he said, you got to come and visit us. So we went to the library, and I talked, she introduced me to the librarian, and I said, oh, it's fun to be there. And she said, you, and I said, well, we're from Rock Island, where Weyerhaeuser began. And she said, no, Weyerhaeuser began out here. And I said, ma'am, no, it did not. On our campus, one of the, Fred Weyerhaeuser and Fred Dankman, just anecdotes here, but it's fun, I mean, these are true. Fred Weyerhaeuser and Fred Dankman, they were a couple of young guys who didn't think a little local lumber yard in Rock Island was being run very well. And so they took it over. And then Weyerhaeuser, and this is cited sometimes in History of Corporate America books, Weyerhaeuser is one of the first one who got the idea that they, other than family, little family operations out east, where they did everything, they got the supplies, they made it, and then they sold it. Weyerhaeuser, in a big corporate level, got the idea that if we could simply buy the forest lands in Wisconsin, that'll allow us to cut the trees, and then we will control the movement of the logs down the Mississippi with our own section, I guess, or division, we would now say, in a firm, and that would bring them down to Rock Island, and then we would mill them there, and that would still be in their name, and then they would become the retail outlet, and it still is. And so Weyerhaeuser was one of the first big companies to control everything from supply point to retail distribution of the product. And so it boomed. He was not environmentally sound at all. I mean, to be honest, he raped the forests of the Midwest. That's the phrase that's often used. They went up and they cut these wonderful huge white pine trees in central Wisconsin along the Chippewa River and up near Eau Claire and so on. And then that stuff came down the river, and they just cut and cut and cut and cut and cut, and they didn't plant anything again. And so they were in Rock Island from 1862 until then, and so a couple of them, his mansion, Weyerhaeuser's mansion that he built in the 1880s, we call it the House on the Hill, we use it for guests on our campus. But Weyerhaeuser left in 1891 to go up to Minneapolis. Dankman, his buddy, stayed around and died there, but gave the college some money, and so our language building now is the Dankman Language Building. It was a nice building built in the 1920s. Eventually, the Weyerhaeuser estate became so the college property, and that's where our residence centers are on, but not because it was several generations removed. It wasn't the original Fred Weyerhaeuser. He was a fellow, do what you gotta do, and then move on to the next place. So he went up to Minnesota, and then they cut the trees up there, and so you can see the Lake States. Notice the center had become that in the late 1880s, so then he had moved from Illinois, be right up in the center of the operations in the Lake States, and he only stayed there 15 years, and then he moved to Seattle. by that point, he had devoured the forests of the upper Great Lakes, the upper Midwest, in Wisconsin and in Minnesota, and there was no replanting. And so a lot of those parts of the state, of those states, now they have trees that are back, as some of you know, but it's all second growth. And so when you go on hikes there, they'll say, oh, you got to go to this place because that's where you can see the size of these original white pines, just immense. They're not as big as your trees out here, but still very, very big. It'll take about three of my arm spans to get around a few remnant white pines that are left. Then I guess the reason Weyerhaeuser says they're from the West, because officially they changed slightly the corporate name when they moved to Seattle. And so they can say, well, technically they're right. The official Weyerhaeuser company, and as you and I know it, yeah, that began in Seattle. Well, yeah, it did, but they had 40-some years. It's still the Weyerhaeuser people in the Midwest. So we have that connection. Keep in mind now, we're talking forest history, but a quick note, in 1872, as many of you may know, that's when Yellowstone National Park was created. We were starting to get a little bit of a movement in the U.S. rather than just people like Thoreau and Emerson and George Perkins Marsh that we mentioned in the Monday lecture, this person who was worried about trees. Instead of people just talking about the doing something for the environment, that the land for Yosemite was given to California, but on condition that it set it aside, it later became a national park. Yellowstone was the first official national park, 1872. Some other parks are added. The National Park Service does not become the NPS until 1916. But that late 19th century, early 20th century, as many of you know, is really sort of the time people began to talk about some things. The movement by then of the center of lumbering had moved to the south. In that latter part of the 19th century, the harvesting of trees in the south, the southern pine particularly, had taken off, and it still is a major producer. So you get something, a company name. I don't know exactly when they began, but we know Georgia Pacific. I mean, clearly that
still
pops out.
The Weyerhaeuser there too.
The Weyerhaeuser went there too, right. But there you had that Georgia Pacific. St. Regis had some initial kinds of interests. We had that. Then, as part of this long story, which I didn't put on, which was not out of that book, but I want to note for you, this is the time when John Muir and Gifford Pinchot both come on the scene. And it's interesting to talk about these two because they are the ones who were together initially on how forests ought to be managed, and then they split. And let me just read a section written by George Lubeck, a scholar on these two. Both men decried the plunder of America's forests during the Gilded Age. Pinchot described it as, quote, the greatest, the swiftest, the most efficient, and the most appalling wave of forest destruction in human history. A consuming belief in the abundance of natural resources, particularly forests, still shaped the public opinion throughout the country in the late 1800s. Muir, likewise, fumed, most settlers regarded trees only as a larger kind of pernicious weeds, extremely hard to get rid of. That's his quote. With no regard for the future, Muir said, these pious destroyers waged interminable forest wars. End of quote. Both men realized that effective forest management was a necessity. Muir commented, and he wondered if such waste would continue until the United States was as barren as Palestine or Spain. For those of you who were here on Monday, it wasn't only George Perkins Marsh, you see Muir, I'm sure, picked up on Marsh's book, The Man and Nature, or The Earth is Modified by Human Action, when he said, don't let happen to the U.S. what happened around the Mediterranean, and here Muir is using the same imagery. Scientific forest management, that was the quest of Gifford Pinchot. In an 1895 piece for Century Magazine, Muir wrote that forests must be and will not be only preserved but used. could yield a certain timber harvest and still retain their aesthetic and spiritual values. Muir stressed that public forests were for public use. At that stage, these two guys were on the same page. Just as a slight anecdote, when my grandfather came over as a Swedish orphan at age 14, one of his first jobs was to be the bellboy in Gifford Pinchot's mansion in New York. I had a lot of good talks with my grandfather, but I didn't come to find out about that connection until he died and until I got interested in forestry. But oh, how many times I wish I could say, hey, Grandpa, what kind of parties were going on in the Pinchot house when President Roosevelt and others were coming? But we have in our possession some wonderful letters, one that is fun to share. Pinchot wrote to my grandfather. My grandfather went into the church, became a church historian, a Lutheran pastor. And we had, so I'm not obviously not making this up, Gifford Pinchot said if he didn't go into forestry, he would have gone into the ministry. I trust he was being truthful, but maybe he said that to 20 people in different professions. But I doubt it. He said that he admired people who worked for the church, and if he wasn't involved in this kind of forestry work, that's what he would have done. Then things began to change. And by the way, much of Pinchot's philosophy is what you'll see through much of the rest of the discussion. This setting, this actually using the forest. Here's how they split, and as many of you know that. For Muir, protection of forest soon came to mean aesthetic preservation of scenic places, in particular wilderness. And as you may know, Muir became the founder of the Sierra Club. Pinchot, P-I-N-C-H-O-T, in contrast, fostered the efficient use of resources, policies embraced in the broader word, conservation. Pinchot's concept of scientific forestry, with its emphasis on utility, wise use, and efficiency, reflected the common assumption of America's progressive reformers in the early 20th century. And so we have that split. Pinchot's focus was on forest resources, forestry, natural resources. Muir wrote about wilderness and about nature. Muir respected the rights, in his own words, he respected the rights of all creation. This perhaps most dramatically separated him from Pinchot and supporters of efficient use of resources. That's still at the center of discussions in forestry in the U.S. And that's why I wanted to take time to read these. Some of you already probably know this story. But those who believe that the forests really do belong under the Department of Agriculture, which is where they are, rather than, let's say, like the National Park Service, and that which is under the Department of Interior, there's a very different thrust between them. Well, back to our table. By the 1920s, it had already moved, the center had moved to the West Coast and right up in this neck of the woods. History has been characterized by the absence of long-term management of land. One of the first real significant acts, though, was with Pinchot's influence, working behind the government even before Theodore Roosevelt was president, permitted the act passed in 1891, the Forest Reserve Act, permitted the president to set aside portions of the public land as public reservations. Again, I wish I had certainly would have had space to bring out the big maps. But many of you know about the Homestead Law, which tried to encourage people to come and set up farms across the Midwest and gave them 160 acres free. And so a lot of land was given away for that. And it was whether it was flat land, whether it was forest land, whatever. And then people began to say, well, what happens if we continue to let average American Joe citizen move in and continue the homestead and cut more trees? And they said, before that goes, let's set it aside. So that's why this is then. So what they did is they pulled out, bit by bit, out of the public domain open to you and I as potential homesteaders. They pulled that out of availability. And so you can see the data. 1893, 17 million acres had been pulled aside. 1896, 38 million. 1900, Roosevelt gets elected president and Pinchot's his buddy. 1905, 86 million acres, and look at that. The next 3 years, the federal government pulled out of access for the general public to retain for federal ownership another 100 million acres. So by 1908, we had 194 million acres, which is essentially the same as it is today. Very little has changed since then. That's essentially the size of the lands that are in the U.S. Forest Service. The U.S. Forest Service was created and was established in 1905 in the Department of Agriculture. Okay, you've got agriculture that grows corn crops and wheat crops, and they happen to harvest in a year, or you've got plants that grow like trees that you harvest every X number of years. They were both seen as crops, and that's why important distinction. And my wife, she really loves, and I do too, love animals and so on. And when we drive through the national forests and they're cutting trees, oh, how can they be doing this, doing that? And you have to say, well, that decision was a key one made in the early 20th century when the Forest Service was placed in the Agriculture Department. Mm-hmm. This is seen as a product that the Earth is providing us, this wonderful resource, but it's available for use.
So, Norm, do you think that's enough? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Please. So the Department of Agriculture sees trees. It doesn't see biodiversity and that sort of thing.
They didn't then. And then within a few minutes, we'll get you the more recent legislation. The Forest Service has been dragged more and more toward a multiple-purpose thing. And that's why by the time we hit 2010, it's a much more holistic view. And that's why that's a positive story. We'll get to that in a minute. But thank you. Yeah, Gina.
Norm, do you think that's enough acreage of forest? Do you think there should be more?
Some thought, it's a perfect question to lead in, some thought there should be more. And so then the next item on your page, the Weeks Act, was passed in 1911, which now gave the federal government, gave the Forest Service the power to buy lands back from people. And so if you travel in the Great Smoky Mountains and look at a map, the Forest Service has quite a band. This is our map of the world. You have that Appalachian system. You have quite a bit of acreage of national forest land that is there. In the upper Great Lakes, there are several national forests in northern Minnesota and northern Wisconsin and the Upper Peninsula. Even in southern Illinois, we have the Shawnee National Forest. So those all were ones that had to be bought back because some people felt they shouldn't be just in Colorado, California, and the Pacific Northwest and Montana. How about putting back in with under some management some of the lands that had already been cut? And that's why they added some, but they lost a few more. So they still, it's a total of about 190 million, but they aren't the same 190 million that were set. Some would say there ought to be more, but there's not money to do that. And an important thing to remember, and that's why unfortunately we only have this short time to go through it all, the largest, and we'll say this right at the very end, the largest category of forest ownership in the United States are, it's around all of us, and certainly in the Midwest, small private woodlots. Your family owns 50 acres, and you got 75, and you got another 110, and you got 30, and you got another part of a farm that isn't used. And when I took my first course related to forestry, one of the books put out was, what can we do to facilitate better use and management of forest by private landowners? I could pass that same book out in 2010, and it would say the same thing and exactly the same issues. It's very, very hard to pull that off. I'll just make a brief note of it, it's in case we won't have time at the end of the hour. In Illinois, they've tried to encourage that a lot. Illinois's got some very good, we have some forests, and they ought to be saved. It's a big prairie state, but there are some areas. And to try and encourage private landowners to do something with good forest management, they reduce the taxes. They don't have to pay the taxes, for the most part, until they're ready to harvest the trees. So instead of paying an annual property tax, you only pay it after you cut the trees, so sometimes it's called a yield tax. They need to get the revenue, but it's unfair to charge a person property tax each year, and then just 2 years before they're going to harvest it, you have a terrible fire, and the whole thing is gone. And so why would a farmer want to do that? Okay, so you're not going to have to pay very much, but then when you harvest the trees, then we're going to connect almost an income tax on that, but it's an incentive to put it in forestry. The state forestry, they'll come around, they'll give seedlings, they'll help you with a forest plan. They go through all that. If he were here, he'd be able to talk for an hour, different kind of incentives. And then I always ask him, are many, that sounds great, how many farmers are going into that? Almost none. And I say, why? Well, in order to qualify to get the state assistance, to get all of this, you have to have a long-term, meaning at least 10 years, that's not too long for trees, a 10-year forest management plan. At that point, the farmers are out the door.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to have anything to do with anybody having a long-term plan. And so, therefore, the money sits, although Illinois finds a way to spend money on other things, so it isn't really sitting. But the intent is there to encourage farmers to manage their private woodlots, have a selective cut every few years, provide enough wood for 10, 20, 50, 100 homes out of this county, out of that county. If that would happen across the country, we would not have to be worried much at all about timber resources. So that's why some would say, should we have more in the Forest Service? Well, maybe just continue to try and get private woodlot people to manage it. So no one's really talking about expansion of the acreage of the Forest Service very much. 1920, it was at its low point. A couple of other things now that we begin, if you turn over onto the other side as we pick up the story. 1960. Look at that on the legislative mandates for balanced use. Look at the very title of that bill in that second and a halfway down the page. The Multiple Use Sustained Yield Act. Well, talking about sustainability. This was a key bill passed in 1960. Notice if you go down, I think yours has the underlined stuff. I underlined this before I knew I was going to use it as a class handout. So it's not like I didn't trust your ability to read here. First, the U.S. Forest Service was made to recognize, this picks up on your comments, sir, was made to recognize other uses of national forests. Second, the act established a balanced management approach, recognizing four primary uses of natural forests. And this still is the policy. That is timbering, watershed maintenance, wildlife habitat preservation, and recreation. And actually, in some way, I think there really ought to be a fifth one. They're including it under, I'm not sure what they're including it on, timbering, but you really ought to put grazing on there also. Because it's a common and it's an accepted practice to let cows come and graze in a forest, which again, that irritates some environmental people because in the corn, the cows are just through, and some of that is material that could be used by the natural animals, but that is part of it. So that's not illegal. So that's why I really think that should have been listed here. It's been possible all along. I think the person who wrote the paragraph just inadvertently left it off. The term watershed maintenance and wildlife habitat preservation, now the phrase, but this was really the start of it, but now the phrase that you'll hear in forest management a lot is ecological services. What are the ecological services of the forest? Retaining the dripping rainwater, having the microorganisms on the forest floor that will help to purify water, the habitat that provides from the smallest insects to the larger mammals, everything that unit functions as an ecological unit. So that's the buzzword now. Instead of literally maybe saying watershed maintenance or the other, it's the provision of ecological services. And they really do talk a lot about that in the management plans now. Although these uses were conflicting, each was to be incorporated into specific management plans for each national forest in the country. And there are about 160 units in the national forest system. That act was important because it acknowledged the balance between the economic, intangible, and ecological values of our forest lands. And notice it was done under the principle of sustained yield advocated by Pinchot a half century earlier. That's 1960. 14 years later, you can pick up this continue, the Forest and Rangeland Renewable Resource Planning Act. Again, notice renewable. That's why It's people that you can, I mean, again, I'm not a professional forester, but you can see why people in the forestry business sometimes make it get a little sort of puzzle scratch heads when they say, oh, the sustainability movement, boy, that's a wonderful thing of the early 21st century. And then, wait a minute here, I think those have been sort of the very words which we've been trying to function under for a long time. And so they don't want to be perceived as being dumb and insensitive to this. And so they pass this, and notice a few lines down, the goal of that act was to assess the quality of national forests every 10 years and recommend a comprehensive management program. It was designed to achieve a balance between economic efficiency, environmental quality, and social values. That was tidied up a little bit more in 1976 with the National Forest Management Act. So you got several bills in that 60s and 70s, which really, that sort of ended some of the exploitation. One of the other key events, though, that I didn't mention, and this is to the credit of the forest industry, was in 1941, the tree farm program was started by Weyerhaeuser. As I said, Weyerhaeuser was not good at all, and even people don't try to cover up for the first 80 years of operation of that company. But by that point, they began to see, and prodded by some people, they began to see, you know, we better start taking care of this because we want to use this stuff for a long time. And so in 1941, the first one in the country out here at Grays Harbor, Washington, when that was set aside, 120,000 acres, they consciously replanted a crop. And at that point, you had a little shorter time frame. Now it's a 50-year time frame for most Weyerhaeuser tree farm operations. You cut it, and those of you who live in the Northwest, they have the signs, and we're going to look at a few here in a minute. You can go down the road, and there you have the signs that tell you cut in 1988 will be harvested in 2038. Cut in 1982, cut in 2032. And so it really depends on what stage. Some of the places may look like very bad cut over to you. It may maybe was cut 4 years ago, and yet if you look there you've got some seedlings that are coming up. Then you see some others that look pretty mature forest, and you look at the sign, and it's ready for cut in 2018 or something like that. And so, okay, that's a wonderful idea. They saw the regenerative powers. They thought that the regenerative powers of nature would regrow new forests if given supporting help in fire protection and intensive management, and they committed them to sustained yield techniques. And I think there's no doubt that Weyerhaeuser has been the leader in this field. So they were the first one. They did a lot of exploitive things, and so the second part of our title to really pretty good management. Now, it's not the same as a primary forest. So as you would think of, with all the diversity of different kinds of micro plants and ferns and mosses, everything else down at the base, so that it truly is an ecosystem. They're not quite there. So people would say, so what good is it? Those are plantations, they aren't forests. But you have to be satisfied with something, and at least the forest, the slopes are being covered. They still are doing a pretty good job then on watershed maintenance and a number of the other things. So that's 1941. And then we already hit the data that by the time we hit 1987, we were at 730 million acres, and it's gone up a little since then. 1993, an interesting development occurred. These everything else now are things that are not on your page. And I'm going to show just a few, and because we have to watch time, and I want to show the slides. But something was set up in 1993, what now is called the idea of certification. And if you keep your eye open for this, there's an organization that really invites a third party to come in and certify if certain forests are being managed wisely. Now, if you want to read something, it comes under, you can check it out, it's the Forest Stewardship Council website. So it's been in place now for 17 years. And what they do is they are invited to come in and look at a forest, federal property or private corporation property, And if you are managing the forest according to these multi-purpose ones, then it will certify you, and then customers, if they are sensitive to this, you can look for wood that bears the imprint of a certified forest. So just like we like to look at products, is this recyclable, this and that for cups and other things, if you're sensitive to this, and if this could catch on more in the country, and it is growing, and it's even there's some influence of this even going internationally, so the Forest Source Council now calls themselves an international group, you can look and try to be sensitive in buying products for this. And so more and more and more properties are wanting to get that. Who knows? We don't want to say this is the end all of the issue, but I think that's a good thing. It's a good start. It's a positive thing on the radar screen. In determining whether a forest is well managed, questions that a certifier would seek to answer would include the following. It's a long document, and I'm not going to read anything of it because time is short, but you can see the very, very detailed kinds of specs that they, here's principle number 4, principle number 5. And so this isn't just a couple of good, simple, feel-good kinds of things. You have about 5 pages of very detailed specifications in order to get the certification. But if we sum it down to 6, is the integrity of the ecosystem being maintained? Are the forest products being harvested at a rate that does not exceed the levels of which they can be sustained? You can measure, biologists, not me, but biologists and forest people can determine approximately what the biomass growth is per year. And if you get approximately the biomass growth per year, then that's what you should in the long run. You can, as long as you cut somehow at the same rate, over the long haul, it should be sustainable. And by the way, as an aside, there are 2 kinds of cutting if you're looking at forests. There's what you see sometimes out here, which is clear cut, where that would be a case even if we use this circle here. We might cut this whole thing and then cut this whole thing. That's so-called, as we know, clear cutting. Or it can be selective cutting, where, okay, we're only going to cut the oak trees or the Doug firs that are ready for harvest. And so we're going to take 5 here, and then there are 10 over here, and 20 here, and so on. You selectively cut. Which at the first you would see, well, that's the only way you can have a sustainable forest. But imagine if Weyerhaeuser had, we may have about 50 stones here, this turns out to be a lucky find, but if Weyerhaeuser has a 50-year cycle, all right, we're going to cut this whole thing in year 1, and then we'll replant that. And this is year 2, and this is year 3, and this is year 49, and they may be moving all over the place, and so, okay, we're back to here, which means this whole area then is sustainable. So that's why clear cutting in itself doesn't have to be bad. It looks bad on the landscape. It's not good for a lot of ecological services, but it can still be a sustainable operation on a big scale. And so that's what they're sort of saying. So you could do that. Are the forest products, so if this is the whole Weyerhaeuser 120,000 acres someplace, they could still be practicing clear cutting and make it work. Are threatened species and their habitats protected? Well, you'd have to do some extra work to get certification to make sure that somehow there is concern for habitat protection, restoration, even if it's clear cutting. And there are ways to do that. Are chemicals and their waste being disposed of off-site in an environmentally appropriate manner? Are all applicable laws regarding the health and safety of employees and their families being obeyed? So now you're even getting into the treatment of the workers. And last, are the rights and resources of people indigenous to the harvest area being respected? I think this is terrific. I mean, this is one of the most positive outcomes, and I'm glad that it's growing. I think people wish it would grow quicker than it is, but this idea of forest certification based on some environmental things, some sustainability things, and care for workers and for, in the U.S., this would be some Native American populations, or if you're in Brazil or Indonesia, concern for those local people. So look for wood, if possible. Is this certified? Another good thing that came out in 1994 out here in the Northwest, Clinton and Gore, gee, they tried to do a good thing. They tried to have a balanced approach. And so they listen to the timber industry, and then they listen to the environmental people, and they chose a pretty nice compromise. They were going to leave 4 million acres open for some harvest, and then they were going to protect 7.5 million acres for some limited thinning and salvage, and then they set aside 2.6 million acres with absolutely no logging. Well, as what often happens with compromises, both sides were furious. The environmental people, how could you continue to let them log this at all? And the timber company said, how can you give away 2.6 million acres? So everybody was mad at Clinton and Gore. But in retrospect, it was a way in which they tried to achieve some balance between these and have a wider area for a wider emphasis on ability to also protect streams, endangered species, wilderness areas, and the like. Just a couple of others, given the time, and that is the EPA in 1994 pushed very strongly the idea of expanding the scale of management, and that's been in place since. It used to be kind of at what they called the stand level. Here's our forest. Let's manage that. But the EPA, in some documents in the 1990s, said that's not enough. We've got to take a look at the forest, the whole watershed scale, the landscape scale, and ecosystem scale. But that's good. Now, again, many of you will say, well, it doesn't look to me like they're doing that. But this is what they're trying to do, and that hadn't even been put in the documents before. And again, as geographers, we're concerned of spatial implications. One way you can reduce some negative things is you simply increase the scale. So now we're starting to get whole people thinking about how should we manage all of the forest lands within this watershed or within an ecosystem where the elk or the wolf populations are moving here and there. So we got to sort of manage the whole system and not chop it off at some point. That was in the 1990s. That's a good thing. Another one that came out, this was 1998, with the Nature Conservancy. It's called Forest Banking. And here I'm just going to read from this document from them. The goal here was the need to conserve across entire landscapes. And this I told some of you the other day, Norm Christensen, a fellow at Duke University, biologist, GI at mine, and that's what they're teaching to those foresters coming out of Duke. You can't just look at the patch, which we would say the stand level. You got to look at the whole landscape. So here comes the Nature Conservancy. The need to conserve across entire landscapes, working landscapes, forests that are both ecologically healthy and economically productive. Try to get people out of the either-or kind of framework is what they're doing. So they're working with private individuals and companies. Nearly three-fourths of the nation's forest land, as we said, that's a little high, but of the private lands, it's very close. Under this, owners receive a steady income or return for the management of their trees by the forest bank. So it's almost like an annuity. We will give these forests to the conservancy. In return, they are going to get the revenue from any of the sales of the trees, but they give up to the professional foresters the management of the property. So it's like going to the bank. The bank's going to earn some interest. Your money, you don't know what the bank, how the bank is investing money or whatever fund you may be in, same idea. You're getting some return on that. Somehow they're taking care of it. In this case, people give the forest land. The Nature Conservancy, we know they're going to have the right managers that are there, and then in return, they are going to get the income. The timber rights go to the Nature Conservancy, but the owner gets the annual payment. The deposits are backed financially by the Nature Conservancy, so in case there's some failure, it is backed up by the resources of the Nature Conservancy. Somehow there's a fight, something else, they're going to get their return coming back from that. When introduced, trees were being cut faster than they were growing, but now that is being reversed in the properties that are there. And now growth is occurring faster than cutting in the properties which they have set aside. Most, the last one here, and then I did kind of look at a few of these. This is the most recent one, 2008. This is really exciting. Plum Creek Timber. This is a place over not too far from here in Montana. Plum Creek Timber is a lumber and real estate firm in Seattle. And what you had was a fragmented checkerboard pattern of 640 acres of forest land here and another 640 there and another 640 there, going back to the days when the railroads got big chunks of free land when they built the railroad. So it was a fragmented one. And again, the Nature Conservancy and others working together and the U.S. Forest Service on that. Recently, in 2008, it was announced they purchased 500 square miles. 500 square miles of timberland for $510 million. Half of that came from private donations and half from the federal government under a unique tax credit bond mechanism. And the people then that would administer it were the Nature Conservancy and the Trust for Public Land. And what it does then is they were able to buy some, again, under this idea of fragmented, if these were owned and these weren't, and this wasn't, and this one was, and that one was, they're buying these parcels in between so that now it will be a more continuous unit. They've got enough money, they bought 500 square miles of property. The purchases were going to take place over 2 years. And then that property would be conveyed to the U.S. Forest Service over a decade. That will fill in the checkerboard. It's great for wildlife. And the cut will be according to certification standards. This is agreed. This is done. And so they're hoping that this will become not just for that section of western Montana, but that this can become the model. Well, again, I want to quickly, we only have a few minutes, just real quick, and I will run through these slides real fast. You asked if you talk now about the Forest Service, what are the big threats to the forestry in the U.S.? Fire and fuels, and you know a lot about that, and that could be a whole week, and it's discussion on its own. Invasive species, that's a big problem that's occurring. They estimate now $138 billion a year loss in the U.S. in economic damages because of invasives. The, again, positive story, though, of the Northern Research Station, which is in Newton Square, Pennsylvania, at least is dealing with our Midwest in the northeast part of this country. They have special studies going on now on invasive species and what they might do to stop that and allow the regeneration of some wonderful American trees, including even the chestnut, trying to see if there's some new way that there can be a new species developed that will not have the problem of the chestnut blight. The loss of open space has been a problem. 34 million acres of open space were lost to development in 19 years, about 6,000 acres per day, and 10 million of that was in forest land. They estimate they could lose 44 million acres of private forest land that could be subject to housing density increases by 2030. So the same problem again, how can you set that aside? Unmanaged recreation. It turns out, and if you could pull the shades as I get into the slides, it turns out that climate change maybe is not too big an issue. In fact, the Resources for the Future suggests that mid-latitude and boreal forests actually may be among the gainers in world change because the slight increase in temperature, slight expansion of the mid-latitude deciduous forests, and a slight expansion in the boreal forests, unless we now create situations where certain insects aren't killed, such as in the Colorado pine situation. But let's go through these real quick. This is the forest of New England that we've come to know and like. Oh, I guess we've got the first time I've had a morning session. Ooh, this is not going to be as good. Okay. Anyway, these are the wonderful forests of New England. Most of these are regenerated. These great things that we now say, oh, isn't this terrific? Much of this would have been cut. And the fall coloration, this would have been cut. And one way you can see that if you walk through the New England forest, in many places here, you have the stone fences And believe me, they weren't put in to somehow have a barrier in the forest. That was separating farm fields. And here's another one going through like that. So that, therefore, all this forest that you see there is all a second growth.
Are the tree species a lot different than they were originally there?
In this case, not too much different. In this case, to my knowledge, again, I'm not the expert on it, but to my knowledge, they're much the same. This is in the Smoky Mountains. Virtually everything in this image or in this one would have been regrowth. This was drastically cut. In the pictures of the Smokies back in the 20s, much of this would have had cut, clear-cut kind of land. But now look at how that's come back. So we have this situation, and here we have this. And one evidence here, as you walk through some of the forest trails in the Smoky Mountains, you get some ornamental bushes that are here. That wouldn't have been there, so you know that you look not too far away, and there you've got some foundations and stones. And here we have a yucca plant. Now, yuccas were not native to the Appalachian Mountains. And so you hike through that, you begin to see, gee, this forest has all come back with types of hardwoods native to the area, but there are some of these remnants that are still there. And in some cases, such as Cade's Cove and Great Smoky Mountain, you see here there was this house, and believe me, John Oliver was not living there so he could have a house in the woods. John Oliver had a house there so that he could farm, and now the forests have come back. Here is the American chestnut that is stunted. It can only grow about to this level. I'm certainly not an expert on that. Not too far south, this is in North Carolina. And this is where, as we'll see in a few, this is, again, much of this has come back. This is where American forestry, managed forestry, really got going in the American Southeast. Now nicely filled back in. This is just south of Asheville, North Carolina. A late March kind of scene. And sure enough, here we see this. There's Gifford again. Before that time, little thought went into it. And then Pinchot, the whole right column, talks about how Pinchot got some started here, so out in the east.
State.
Yeah, right, at Pisgah National Forest. And here we have, driving down the road, there we have the booster sign, Cradle of Forestry in America, and they've got a wonderful forest discovery center, and they're taking kids and adult civic groups and so on to come into this place. That's exciting news. We go out to your territory, and Janet and I, and you folks who live close to Olympic Peninsula, you're lucky to have these scenes. One of the favorite trails for us in the world is the Hoh River Trail on the west side of the Olympic Mountains. If though some of you haven't been to this place, you got to put it on your list. HOH, it's on the right along the west side of the Olympic National Park. And these are the old growth trees, which have not been cut. That's a big fight, of course, that still is unfortunately being played out. Some say, continue to have the plantations, but please don't cut any more of the old growth. And I think most people would say, you got plenty of trees to meet our needs, and leave these, at least these gems. And the size of these, as many of you in the room know, is just astounding.
That's Western Red Cedar.
They're either red cedar or Sitka spruce, and some are Doug fir, but usually the bigger ones are the cedars or the Sitka spruce. I don't know which
one
this is.
That's a downed log, right?
Yeah, that's a downed log, and that's my wife standing next to it. And then every time I think, and it's me, of course, I think I'm exaggerating this. At school, almost here, you have sort of your standard blackboard or whiteboard width. And when I look at that, when I get back and I'm ready to tell the class, you know, the trees out in this area, they're as wide as that blackboard. I'm thinking, oh, geez, Norm, you're exaggerating stuff again. But then I show this as a reminder. This tree, if I stretch my arms out, you can see I'm only getting about two-thirds of the diameter of these trees. These are just wonderful gems. It's hard to catch the height on them, but they are up about 170, 200, 220 feet tall, in some cases higher. This is the place where, as the Sierra Club calls it, the bounteous forest, where you get the mosses, you get they call it a nurse tree function, you get the mushrooms, you get all kinds of, like you have around here, the mosses. Nurse trees are ones that are down, and then the other ones just start their roots hanging over the side. this is the true form. You won't see this in the plantations, and so therefore believers in this really still mourn when they see a tree farm. That's the ferns. This is up at Opal Creek in Oregon. Some of you may know this story, southeast of Portland. This was ready to be lost, but it hit the national media. We have still have that video that we kept, and other people rallied. This was the last of the lower level old growth forests in the United States. And it was ready to, pardon?
In Oregon.
In Oregon, that's right, in Oregon. And it was ready to be lost, but they managed to save it. And so now Opal Creek has been saved. And again, if you have a terrific place to see, they also have an outdoor center, and yeah, there's my wife as a true tree hugger. We had a number of people. You can get almost a whole, not in this one, but in some of these, you can get a whole class under those. No exaggeration. You can get about 20 people underneath that tree and feel safe about it. And of course, here again, one of the nice things in which the people at Opal Creek stress this ecological services idea. That forest is making the water that finally reaches its way to the Willamette better. And that's one of the unseen things, that one of those purposes. Here's not too far from us here in the Northwest is the Gifford Pinchot National Forest, one of the 160 units in the system. Yeah. But then you see this clear cut. And it really, you can't exaggerate it enough, as some of you know. This, I think, is Chelan. I can't tell. This was a flight going from Seattle home, and there aren't too many other big lakes. So somewhere near us, back further down, you see some of the clear-cut operations. Often they're hard to see by road, because the timber companies often leave a buffer of trees. So you'll drive around out here, unless you get an air view, you'll think, gee, I didn't realize there was that much cut. Well, yeah, go through the woods 50 yards. This is from Olympic National Park, looking the long distance to Rainier, and as soon as you leave the park, this is the Forest Service. You can't, the Park Service, you can't cut trees at all. But the forest, so you're going here from National Park property to National Forest property. Whoa. Grim kinds of scenes like this, and it's so many places. Helicopter removal on the steepest of slopes. Log trucks. You've seen, any of you who travel in the West, you'll see these. The lumber industry has had a big hit. I know that that's out here, part of that compromise during the 1990s. These are some logs being shipped overseas, heading off to Japan or some other place. And then here comes Weyerhaeuser into the picture. This is their headquarters at Federal Way. And here we have America's first industrial tree farm, as we noted it. Some of the signs here were taken. This area is planted. Now, they say it looks kind of bad, but if you start to look carefully through here, you're getting some trees in this section that are 3 or 4 feet tall. That will mature. At least they took the time to replant it. This doesn't look good. It's in the early stages, but that whole area has been replanted. And they leave enough brush at the bottom to help slow down runoff, so that even while it's the young trees, the rains come, it's going to stop some of that. And here again, you could have a lot to read. It was clear cut harvested in 1979, and the next harvest is going to be 2029. The Doug Fir operations, here's another one of these signs. Cut in 85, planted 86, harvest in 36. This is a plantation. Now again, it's not the same as the whole river trail, but it's better than a bare slope. And that's why you gotta be thankful for small gifts. It's not what you would wish. These are the plantation trees. This is one of the old growths left, a big difference. So this is not as good as the others, again, as I've said many times. This is at the earlier stage. These are the trees at the seedling place of Weyerhaeuser. And so they're collecting the seeds coming from these, and they've got a nice mix of female, male, and all, whatever goes in. It's farm expertise and the regeneration of these, but they collect these seeds. And then they start to care for them in this facility by Rochester, Washington. And it's hard to think of these little things here. Each one of these little things here is a Doug Fir, or is a Fraser Fir, something that's about an inch high. it's hard to, that can't be a Doug Fir. Well, they are. And these are a little bit bigger. this is not normally open for tours, but when we bring our students out, they give us about 3 hours of introduction to this stuff. It's impressive of what they're doing. Then they take some over to the Mima Nursery, and over 20 million tree seedlings are shipped annually out of this place to Washington State and across the country. Here, preparing this area, they have different sections you'll see in a minute or two. Again, these are little Doug firs or Fraser firs that are starting up. They're there for 2 years. And these then are nearing the end of like a year and a half time frame. They got a little more growth. And when you look out across that vast landscape, they have 40 million in that little property. 40 million little trees. And some of them will go to Weyerhaeuser, some will go elsewhere. Here they are. These will be shipped out shortly after this height. And some will go out to their own tree farm properties. Some will go out to the Midwest, to Minnesota, to elsewhere as part of the reforestation. And we end with these three scenes. This is some of the tragedy, that this is the impact of global warming. They think that somehow it's not getting quite as cold in Colorado, and therefore there's pine beetle. And so we were out there last year, and this is just a little section in Rocky Mountain National Park. And you get some sections like this, and then you get some sections like this. You just get over the Front Range on the other side. Just everything, as far as you can see, is dead. And they're not sure what caused that, but some speculate that that could be part of the global warming issue. So I guess that I'll say one thing, and then we'll take questions. I appreciate your extra time on this today. But there's some good things, I think, that are happening in forestry. Not as great as if it were prime forests, but there's some creative things going. I think this forest banking, I think the certification, the thing with that tree that lasted until 2008, thing that I mentioned there, the Plum Creek, the thing I like about that is you've got some private donations coming in, you've got some corporations that are involved among those supporting it, you've got the Nature Conservancy, the Trust for Public Land, and the federal government together working those things out, and that's the way it's going to go, and it's where it's not only the environmentalists versus the production people, you're still going to cut some trees, but you're going to have ecological services, and that's exactly what the textbooks say. That's what, so all the question marks in the title of this session, sort of where are we going? You hope that those question marks in for our the next generation in 30 years will be able to say, you know, they really started to do some good things in the late 20th and early 21st century. Any questions? Please.
I just have two comments. One of which is the computer world is changing the need for paper. And so the use of the pulp mills and our demand for paper to print things or on, and the fact that newspapers are not, they're closing down essentially, is changing that whole world. In our area here in the Northwest, we're seeing cottonwood forests being developed for paper use.
Thank you.
The other thing that I was going to say is the whole planting process gets into the immigration problem, because to find people to do that planting is not easy. It can't be done by machine.
That's great, and that's right. It's one is grateful that somebody's willing to do that job. I mean, that's the other side, that they're able to get people to work at the warehouse. That some of that work is pretty hot over at Rochester in the summer. And when we're there, most of our students are glad that they're getting back in the air conditioning van, and that wasn't their job. So it's a good thing someone's willing and able to do that.
Talk a little bit about the import and export of forest products, because I'm aware of certain importations that we're making, Luan, things like that. But and I obviously you were saying that some of this stuff is being exported to Japan and whatnot. Where are we in terms of percentage of meeting our own needs with sustainable growth? Mm-hmm. And
I don't know the number, but more is coming from overseas than from domestic, and it's part of that whole supply chain, the equatorial rainforest, not just in South America, but in Indonesia. It's horrible. In the southern part of Borneo and across there, I know there's a lot that's going on, and to this day, some of that's going to China, it's going to Korea, South Korea, it's going to Japan, it's going to the U.S., it's going to the places that are the so-called developed nations that need still a lot of wood products. I'm sorry, sir, I don't know the percentage in the U.S.
So ultimately, my question might be, we have some good news here
right. If I were a Maine forestry specialist, I should deal with that. I do not teach a lot about East Asia, and I know in Japan I get furious with them because they've worked hard to get more of Japan reforested, but they are among the major buyers in the Philippines and Malaysia and Indonesia. So there's a book out on the ecological shadow of Japan, and it's huge. That's what they call it. And so I'm aware of it there, and your question prompts me. I should know more precisely what ours are here and how much of an ecological shadow are we. I will get our own slopes looking better, but meanwhile the companies are buying over there and doing not such good things.
The number one source of wood products in the States, other than the United States itself, comes from Canada.
Yeah, that's true.
So we have the same forestry laws, same practices as down here. Although we're facing the mountain pine beetle, we've got tracts of land bigger than New England that are dead.
Yeah.
But, it's most of your softwood coming into building homes and that is coming from British Columbia and then also from Ontario.
One of the articles, I'm glad, thank you, sir, for that. One of the articles we pass out is about the destruction of the boreal forest, which doesn't get much attention. Because everybody hears about the Amazon, but one person has calculated if you take the cut to growth ratio, equatorial rainforest, you cut it, but the stuff grows so fast, you get up into British Columbia, or I saw some in Alberta like this years ago, but they tell you how long it takes for trees to grow, and it takes a long time. So if you really are worried about growth to cut ratio, the loss of the boreal forest should go right up there.
There was just a huge deal signed regarding the boreal forest. Stretches from Ontario all the way through the Northwest Territories.
And what was the substance of the deal?
The substance of the deal was that it's a joint project between the forestry industry, the environmental groups, and with the goal of making it sustainable. So significant portions will be preserved for migratory routes, everything else, as well as leaving the slower growing for less harvest.
So it's a good deal.
It's a very good deal.
All right, thank you for that. Well, we have to, I'll take one more, then those of you have to run, but let's have one more and then we go.
The wilderness set asides are usually high up and the stuff grows really slow, and so we like to keep that stuff, the meadows and all of that stuff. But now they're working along the lower front on the other side of the Cascade Range, trying to keep that open for timber growth, because it grows faster down there in those lowlands, and we can keep them out of the rivers and streams down there and not fill that area full of houses, which is the trend.
Yep.
But if we could, in that way, we can persuade the foresters not to let that land go down there.
Yeah.
And so we're working on it, but it's really tough for us.
A lot of work to do, quite a few good signs. Hey, thanks much for your time.